And that, what number was that in the red book?
668.
All right. Good morning. It's wonderful to see your bright, shining faces, just like the sun outside. Beautiful, smiling faces. I really appreciate, especially those of you who, or as Dan Malier would call it, seasoned citizens, and come and assemble here with discomfort and aches and pains. And I work very hard to, in my speaking, not to add to that pain. And sometimes I succeed, and sometimes I fail. But we're constantly working on it. Delivery and time and avoiding monotony and all that kind of stuff. 2 weeks ago, we were asking a series of questions, actually. That was the main question, why am I here? But we considered three questions that every individual and every human being at some point in their lives asks themselves, whether sitting on a beach or up in the mountains or in a hammock sipping on a lemonade at some point, maybe at various different times, they ask these three questions: where did I come from? And another variation of that is, how did I get here? We ask ourselves, why am I here? And where am I going? Now, we spent 99% of our time on why am I here? And another way to phrase that question is there a purpose? Does my life have a purpose? What is the purpose of my life? And some people might ask it this way: why on earth am I here? And then there's that familiar question, which we see in comics and books and movies, sometimes in a flippant manner: what is the meaning of life? There might even be a movie with that title. What is the meaning of life? What is it? So when we consider why I was placed on this planet, our premise 2 weeks ago was this right here, that we must begin with God. And I respectfully ask those who may have been in our audience last time, who may be humanists or atheists or evolutionists, unbelievers, to bear with us on this point and to allow the Bible and God to speak through His Word. Allow them an audience and a hearing. And I entreat you today to continue to do the same thing. Start with God, because the alternative is this right here. If we're not devoted to God, we will devote our life to things, to us. We will become self-centered, devote our lives to things, and that will lead to a dead life, a dead end. And many of you have observed people who have reached this point, right? They have no meaning, purpose. They're wandering around in life, disoriented, wondering what to do with themselves. On the contrary, Proverbs described for us a God-shaped life. He who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like a green leaf. The contrast to that was read by Mo in Jeremiah 17, verses 5 through 8. Cursed is the man who trusts in mankind and makes flesh his strength, and whose heart turns away from the Lord. What is he going to be like in that context? He will be like a bush in the desert and will not see when prosperity comes. He'll live in stony waste places, a land of salt without inhabitant. Remember 2 weeks ago, we fleshed this out a little bit and pictured a lonely bush out there in the desert, a salty place, not inhabited. But you know what, folks? You can live in a big city and feel like this, can't you? How many people live in big cities with lots of people around them, and they feel like a bush out in the desert all alone? Why? Because their focus is on themselves. They're self-centered. And then they end up having no purpose. They can't find meaning in life and no purpose in life. Cursed is the man who trusts in mankind. Jeremiah also gives us the flip side. But he whose trust is the Lord and is in the Lord, that's verse 7, he'll be like a tree planted by the water. Isn't that a beautiful picture? Tree planted by the water. We considered Colossians and Job together, and the concept that we build upon our premise that we must begin with God is this. You didn't create yourself, so there is no way that you can tell yourself why you are here. Another way to word that is, life will make no sense if you do not understand or believe that you were made by God and for God. And we considered Romans 8:6, that paraphrase down there, obsession with self in these matters is what? A dead end. There's our dead life, dead end picture. Isaiah 45:18 does not give us any excuses, any apologies. It's just matter-of-fact statement. Thus says the Lord who created the heavens, and we focus on the parenthetical phrase there. He is the God who formed the earth and made it. He established it and did not create it a waste place, but formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, there's none else besides me. In other words, you are not an accident. That's what we have up here at the top. He has a reason for everything He creates. He never does anything accidentally. He never makes mistakes. Every plant and animal was made for a purpose, and God is not haphazard. If He planned this earth and this universe with precision and with a purpose and with a reason, brethren, then your life has a reason. You have a reason for living. And it's so sad to see people who come to the conclusion that there is no reason for living. Here's the flip side. If there's no creator God, then you are an accident. If you and the earth are here by random chance, then life is not going to have any purpose or meaning. There's no right and wrong. There's no significance. There's no hope. Absolutely none whatsoever. And Isaiah 29:15-16 kind of pokes fun at mankind, but it's actually an exhortation. But he's asking us, shall what is formed, that would be us, say to him who formed it, he did not make me? Can the pot say to the potter, he knows nothing? What's happening when you ask these questions or these statements? He did not make me and he knows nothing. It's right here. You turn things upside down. And we concluded 2 weeks ago with this question right here, asking ourselves, what is the purpose of life? Well, let's ask ourselves, what makes God smile? Numbers 6 is where we turn to. We make God smile when we love Him supremely. The Lord said, with all our heart and all our soul and all our mind. When we use our abilities, when we trust Him completely, when we praise and thank Him continually. Which brings us to our main point this morning. Another way of asking why I am here is to ask ourselves, what drives your life? What is it that drives your life? Sometimes we think we have it figured out, but James reminds us, you don't even know what tomorrow's going to bring, and your life here is just a vapor. But think about the concept of driving something. For example, driving a nail. If I'm going to drive a nail, I'm going to guide it and direct it and control it. And I'm not in the construction trade in real life, but if I'm going to guide, see, that is guiding and controlling and directing that nail. And the purpose is to build something, usually. Same thing with a car. You drive and control, you're directing the car, same thing. Larry can relate to the golfing. Larry does plenty of golfing. He drives and hopes to drive and control and direct that ball. It leads to a question. What is the driving force in your life? In other words, what is guiding and controlling and directing you at this moment? What is it? A fellow named Thomas Carlyle He said, a man without purpose is like a ship without a rudder, a waif, a nothing, a no man. Many people are driven by guilt. Let's look at a few things that people are driven by. Guilt is one of them. And those of you who are part of this congregation, you know that we just recently concluded a series called The Storms Within, and we looked at guilt and what it does to the soul if it's not taken care of. People driven by guilt, they spend their entire lives running from regrets or hiding shame. The guilt-driven are manipulated by their memories, aren't they? They allow their past to control their future. We are products of the past, but we don't have to be prisoners of it. When God's purposes are integrated into your life and my life, then you're not limited by your past. If you have God's purposes in your life, He specializes in giving people a fresh start, and that's why we have Psalm 32, verses 1 through 5 up there. Some people are driven by resentment and bitterness and anger. They hold on to hurts and they never get over them. We had a lesson on this, bitterness. An entire lesson on it. It's amazing how much the Scripture speaks to this, so I won't get into a lot of detail. But instead of releasing their pain through forgiveness, many people rehearse it over and over in their mind, and it builds up and becomes very bitter and ugly. If you worry yourself to death with resentment and anger, that is a foolish thing to do. Some people are driven by crippling fear. Fear of the world events. Fear of what's happening around them. Fear of interacting with people. Fear and worry over debt. And then guilt over how they got there. Fear of anything new. Fear of confrontation. Fear of enemies. What does 1 John 4:18 tell us? There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. So we've looked at guilt and resentment and anger and fear. And we're asking ourselves, what drives us in our life? What's our purpose? Another way of asking is, what drives us? And some of these things drive people. Guilt, resentment, anger, and fear. And this group here in Mount Vernon knows that many times I've brought up the illustration of that TV show called The Hoarders. Anybody seen that? The Hoarders? I can't watch it too much because I almost get sick to my stomach seeing some of the situations that people allow themselves to get into, mainly their living conditions. Some of the living conditions are just turn your stomach. They're just filthy and awful. And it's interesting to watch psychologists trying to deal with these people and help them to work out of that. And in many cases, as they dig deeper and deeper, figuratively speaking, into the lives of these people, they find out that there is guilt, resentment, anger, or fear, or a combination of those things that they have not dealt with in their past. Now, this past month, where's my mother-in-law? Right there. We've been moving my in-laws, Ward and Kay, out of a 4,000-foot square house into a 900-square-foot place. Did a lot of purging. I describe my mother-in-law as a organized collector. Her house was neat and clean at all times, but once we started getting into cabinets and closets, we realized she's an organized collector. I mean, 26 jars of peanut butter, 8 sets of bed sheets had never been opened. She asked me one time, "Do you think I'm a hoarder?" So I'm answering that right now. Ward and Kay are not hoarders in the sense that I'm talking about here. They are children of the 30s, of the Depression. So it's understandable that through their lifetime, it's just drilled into them. Save, 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 collect, collect, collect. So don't fear, Mom. I'm not putting you in this category. Some people are just crippled by this in various ways and forms. Some people are driven by materialism. It's a way of thinking a way of thinking that gives too much importance, as you see up there, to material possessions rather than to spiritual or intellectual things. Merriam-Webster. It said, the desire to acquire becomes the passionate goal, and it consumes people's entire lives. Unfortunately, there is a misconception when it comes to materialism, and that is that self-worth is equal to net worth. In other words, what you think about yourself and the value of yourself is equal to what you own and possess. That, brethren, is a misconception. That is false. Another misconception is that your value is determined by your valuables. That's just another way of saying the first thing. That is also false. Examine the image on the left. See there, it's in some kind of department store. We've got some mannequins there with clothing on it. Look at the advertisement on the wall in the back. Pretty subtle, huh? Is that subtle? Subliminal messages. I want, I want, I want. That's America's motto today, isn't it? That's our theme. Materialism may find us in the I want lane. Now, the next frame is going to illustrate some materialism, and I'm going to use three female celebrities, images of three current female celebrities, and I'm addressing the young men in our audience, if we have any, single or not, but especially single. And I don't want you to be repulsed when I put them up here, because their lifestyles in many ways are repulsing. But we have Jennifer Lawrence, who's in acting, Kate Upton, who's in modeling, and that other one, who I think is in music and acting. Her name is Miley Cyrus. Now, we don't know their character. None of us have sat down and interviewed them to find out what kind of people they actually are. We're kind of judging by their words and their behavior as we see them in mainly on commercials and those kind of things and in movies. And I'm going to make the assumption that these are Proverbs women. Not Proverbs 31, but probably Proverbs chapter 5 and chapter 7. You'll read those sometime this afternoon. If I was to use Old Testament terminology, I would describe these as the daughters of men. These are not women that you find among the sons of God. These are the daughters of men. And I have no doubt that these women, they are very famous and current right now in your news if you ever get into that Hollywood celebrity type news. They are being exploited by managers and agents and companies and themselves to get value or use out of them. And for what purpose are they being exploited? They know that the wrinkles are on the way, don't they? 10 to 12 years from now, if not sooner, they're going to be on the downhill slope. So it's accumulate now and it's acquire right now. And that's what they do any way they can do it. Now what if we were to ask them, are you content? Any one of these three. Are you filled with joy? Are you at peace? Are you fulfilled? What do you think the answer would be? They probably think so. They'd probably say yes, and then they would begin to describe to you how they feel fulfilled. The one on the far right is probably going to follow in the steps of Lindsay Lohan. Lindsay Lohan was a Disney child actor. So was this one, Miley Cyrus. And Lindsay Lohan is now a alcoholic, professional alcoholic, from what I can tell. And she's a famous one. This one here will probably end up that way. You could put a lot of celebrities, especially female celebrities, up here. Beyonce, Kim Kardashian, Katy Perry, Justin Bieber. Oh, he's not a female, is he? Okay, sorry about that. Are there some young men here thinking that, you know, it'd be tempting for young men to think, boy, I would like to meet somebody like this and perhaps I could teach them the gospel. Well, you know, that is a worthy goal. I wonder if any of us have ever thought about praying for young women like this, actually using their names and praying for them, that they may in some point in their life come to know the Lord. Have you ever thought about that? But young men, I want you to kind of consider this verse up here. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful men, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. So be very careful when you're out there and meeting other people, and observe them, and talk to them, and question them, and examine them to see where their goals are headed. What is their purpose in life? You don't figure that out and you come together in a union, there's going to be a lot of clashing and a lot of controversy, isn't there? A lot of conflict. So be very, very careful where materialism leads. Some people are driven by need for approval. Many adults are trying to earn the approval of unpleasing parents. And then some worry about what others may think. And that's a quick way to drive yourself crazy, isn't it? It's a very quick way to drive yourself crazy. These things, guilt, approval, being driven by fear and materialism and resentment, makes it difficult to get a good night's sleep when you're being driven by those things. But if you're being driven by a purpose for the things of God, this right here, the purpose-driven life for God, there are many, many benefits. There are many, many benefits to knowing your purpose. First of all, knowing your purpose gives meaning to your life. Look at Jeremiah 29, 11 through 13 when you can. The context there is physical Judah returning to their physical homeland back then in that time period. But there are some spiritual undertones and connotations there that are wonderful to meditate upon. Knowing your purpose simplifies your life. You say, well, how in the world does it do that? Well, it defines what you do and what you don't do. Without a clear purpose, then there's no foundation on which to base your decisions or to allocate your time or to use your resources. People who don't know their purpose try to do too much. Have you ever thought about that and observed that in people? And this causes stress, it causes fatigue, and it causes conflict. Whoops. Knowing your purpose also focuses your life. Knowing God's purposes for your life concentrates your effort and your energy on what is important. You become effective by being selective. If you have no clear purpose, then you're going to keep changing directions, changing jobs, changing relationships, hoping that each new change will settle the confusion and fill the emptiness. But knowing purpose focuses your life. Knowing your purpose also motivates. Purpose always produces passion. Nothing energizes like a clear purpose. Would you agree with that? It's meaningless work, not overwork, that wears us out and robs us of joy. It's the meaningless work. The true joy of life is to live for God. And knowing your purpose down here also prepares you for eternity. All achievements are eventually surpassed. All records are eventually broken. Think of Michael Phelps. How many gold medals has he won? Olympic swimmer, right? We've lost track, haven't we? What's going to happen to those gold medals in 10, 15 years? 20, 30. He's probably going to donate those to a museum or something, right? So that his descendants won't lose them. Right? Won't look at them and say, what are these? And throw them out. But still, are those gold medals going to get him into heaven? Get anyone into heaven? Into an eternal afterlife? Or how much happiness and joy and peace are those going to gold medals give anybody right now while they're alive? Given time, all trophies will be trashed by someone else. This is somebody's representation of a guy that was called the Hermit of the North Pond. So I'm going to give you an example in contrast of what we've been talking about here. An example in contrast of this right here, knowing your purpose. All right? So if you give me just a couple minutes. The hermit set out of camp at midnight, carrying his backpack and his bag of break-in tools, and threaded through the forest, rock to root to rock, every step memorized, not a boot print left behind. It was cold and nearly raided, so he hiked about an hour to the Pine Tree Summer Camp, a few dozen cabins spread along the shoreline of North Pond in central Maine. With an expert twist of a screwdriver, he popped open the door of a dining hall and slipped inside, scanning the pantry shelves with his pin light. Candy! Always good. 10 rolls of Smarties stuffed in a pocket. Then into his backpack, a bag of marshmallows, 2 tubs of ground coffee, some Humpty Dumpty potato chips. I never heard of those, have you? Burgers and bacon were in the locked freezer. On a previous raid at Pine Tree, he had stolen a key to the walk-in, and now he used it to open the stainless steel door. The key was attached to a plastic 4-leaf clover keychain with one of the leaves partially broken off. It was a 3.5-leaf clover. He could have used a little more luck. Newly installed in the Pine Tree kitchen, behind the ice machine, was a military-grade motion detector. The device remained silent in the kitchen, but sounded an alarm in the home of Sergeant Terry Hughes, a game warden who had become obsessed with catching the thief. Hughes lived a mile away. He raced to the camp in his pickup truck and sprinted to the rear of the dining hall, and he peeked in a window. And there he was, probably. The person stealing food appeared entirely too clean. His face freshly shaved, he wore eyeglasses and a wool ski hat. Was this really the North Pond Hermit? A man who tormented the surrounding community for years, decades, yet the police still hadn't learned his name. So Hughes calls a state trooper who came, and she began to question the hermit. Hughes apprehends him, puts him in handcuffs. She comes and takes the handcuffs off and talks to him. And he eventually revealed his name. It was Christopher Thomas Knight, born December 7th, 1965. He said he had no address, no vehicle, did not file a tax return, did not receive mail. He said he lived in the woods. For how long, wondered the state trooper. Knight thought for a bit and then asked when the Chernobyl nuclear plant disaster occurred. He had long ago lost the habit of marking time in months or years. This was just a news event he happened to remember. The nuclear meltdown took place in 1986, the same year, Knight said, he went to live in the woods. He was 20 years old at the time, not long out of high school. He was now 47, a middle-aged man. Knight stated that over all those years, he slept only in a tent. He never lit a fire for fear that smoke would give his camp away. He moved strictly at night. He said he didn't know if his parents were alive or dead. He did not make one phone call or driven a car or spent any money. He had never in his life sent an email or even seen the internet. 27 years he lived as what we call a hermit. Now, yes, there are hermits that have probably never been discovered and survived a lot longer, but this was just kind of an interesting story about the background of this fella who was tracked by a journalist. So this journalist is named Michael Finkel, and he took an interest in this fella, and he began eventually a pen pal relationship with this guy once he was in jail. The hermit was in jail. And then he was able to actually sit face-to-face with him and visit with him while he was in jail. And this journalist even went to this hermit's camp. Chris Knight had taken the authorities, Hughes and the trooper, to his camp. And so later this journalist goes and finds it. It took him a while to find it, but he found it. And it's a very long story. I'm not reading all of it. But we're getting down to... Remember our theme today. What is the meaning and purpose of your life? By what are you driven? Now, this journalist says, following his arrest, the court of public opinion was deeply divided. The man who wanted to live his life as invisibly as possible had become one of the most famous people in Maine. He could not walk into a bar. You could not walk into a bar in the Augusta area without stumbling into a debate about what should be done with Christopher Knight. Some said he must be immediately released from jail. Stealing cheese and bacon are not serious crimes. Now, I'll just do an aside. He stole way more than that. He stole supplies and clothing and all sorts of stuff from people who had camps and cabins in that area. All right? The man was apparently never violent. He didn't carry a weapon. He's an introvert, not a criminal. He clearly has no desire to be a part of our world. Let's open a Kickstarter and get him enough cash for a few years' worth of groceries and allow him to go back to the woods. Some people were willing to let him live on their land rent-free. Others countered that it wasn't the physical items he robbed that made his crime so disturbing. He stole hundreds of people's peace of mind, their sense of security. How were they supposed to know Knight wasn't armed and dangerous? Even a single break-in can be punishable by a 10-year sentence. If Knight really wanted to live in the woods, he should have done so in public lands, hunting and fishing for food. He's nothing but a lazy man and a thief 1,000 times. Lock him up in the state penitentiary. So that was the other side of the argument. Now, before his release, the journalist says, I met with Chris again. He said he'd be returning home to live with his mother. And he asked him, the journalist asked him, you must have thought about things, I said, about your life, about the human condition. Chris became surprisingly introspective. I did examine myself, he said. Solitude did increase my perception, but here's the tricky thing. When I applied my increased perception to myself, I lost my identity. With no audience, no one to perform for, I was just there. There was no need to define myself. I became irrelevant. The moon was the ultimate minute hand. The seasons, the hour hand. I didn't even have a name. I never felt lonely. To put it romantically, I was completely free, unquote. The journalist writes, that was nice, but still, I pressed on. There must have been some grand insight revealed to him in the wild. He returned to silence, Chris did. Whether he was thinking or fuming or both, I couldn't tell, though he did arrive at an answer. I felt like some great mystic was about to reveal the meaning of life. And here it is. This is the meaning of life from this hermit. Get enough sleep. Can you go home today and does that pick you up? Woo! We're driven now. We know how to handle life. Get enough sleep. Now, is that important? Well, sure it is. He set his jaw in a way that conveyed he wouldn't be saying anymore. This is what he'd learned, and I accepted it as truth. That's the writer. Quote, what I miss most, he eventually continued, is somewhere between quiet and solitude. What I miss most is stillness. And he was worried about a mushroom that was growing on the trunk of a Douglas fir in his camp. And the writer assured him, it's okay, it's still there. But at the very end of our visits, I'd always ask him the same question, an essential question. Why did he disappear? And he never had a satisfying answer. I don't have a reason, quote. I can't explain why, quote. Give me more time to think about it, quote. It's a mystery to me too. And then he became annoyed. Why? That question bores me. But during our final visit, he was more reflective. Isn't everybody, he said, seeking the same thing in life? Aren't we all looking for contentment? He was never happy in his youth, not in high school, not with a job, not being around other people. Then he discovered his camp in the woods. I found a place where I was content, he said. His own perfect spot, the only place in the world he felt at peace. And then he could live a life where the end justifies the means. You know, stealing from all these people was the way he had to survive. Which was wrong, of course. Poor guy, he doesn't know it, does he? He took himself out of society. He stole a lot of books. He did a lot of reading. But he said he never stole a Bible. What are you guys thinking? Well, he should have stolen the Bible and started reading it. Boy, life puts us in quandaries sometimes, doesn't it? Steal the Bible. Man, so there's the purpose of life, people. Get enough sleep. There's his camp right there, a picture of it. I mean, he was in between some boulders. He had everything worked out. There he is right after he was captured, I think, because this is the surveillance video of when he's in the pine tree camp, I believe. And once he got into prison, he just let his beard grow out and everything like that. And he looks like what people would call a hermit once he got in prison. Ecclesiastes 3:11, he has made everything appropriate in his time. He has also set eternity in their hearts. This is why, brethren, we ask the why we are here. Because God has set a longing, a yearning in our hearts. Do you ever remember that radio commercial, NorthwestWashingtonHelpWanted.com? Long name, amazing results. Well, same thing with Ecclesiastes. Long name, but amazing results if we understand the viewpoint of the author. Ecclesiastes is coming from the viewpoint that life on earth is all there is. That life here under the sun is all there is, and there's nothing else. And I'm not going to find out or figure out why things happen on life here on earth if life here on earth is all there is. The writer observes all the inequities in life, the achievements that are forgotten, the hard work and losing all you've accumulated, the wicked prospering like crazy, and the righteous are poor as dirt, or dying, and the young ones who die in infancy. And if life on earth is all there is, you look at it and you think, man, this is empty. It's vanity, vanity, vanity. That's the word that he uses over and over again in Ecclesiastes. Is that right? Over and over. Reward or regret? Are you accountable? That is our question this morning. Why am I here? Lord, you give perfect peace to those who keep their purpose and put their trust in you. The New American words it this way. The steadfast of mind you will keep in perfect peace because he trusts in you. Now, 2 weeks ago, we're going to wrap up with a reminder of our illustration from 2 weeks ago. Remember the rope? And Mo helped us out. Now, the problem with illustrations is they're limited. The rope is limited when it tries to illustrate eternity because it has an end. But as eternity, as far as I know, does not have an end. It keeps on going. So this white rope represents eternity. And just picture it going around the earth several times and way out past the moon and past all the planets, Jupiter, to where we can't see the end. That's eternity. And this here represents your life. This little black thing, you're born here and you die here. And you're doing all sorts of things in here. You're working, you're going to school, you're planning for your career. You get your career, you have children and family, you teach them to work and plan and build their careers and you accumulate things and you're really busy here in this life, doing a lot of things here in this life, and then right here, what's this here? You die. And what's after death? Have you been planning and thinking about this part here all the way out there? The eternity part? Where will you spend eternity? Where will you spend the afterlife? Are you preparing for it now? And it's not a matter of working till you build up some kind of eternity life insurance. What is the eternal life insurance? Who gives that to us? Who provides it? God, through the gift of His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, being washed in the blood of the Lamb. Are you thinking about the Lamb of God right now, where you sit? Are you thinking about what He provides? Are you willing to humble yourself, not be self-centered, but accept Him as the Lord of creation, the one who gave His life for you? And are you willing to serve Him the rest of your life and to serve others? The invitation from Him is open. Let's stand and sing the song that Austin selected. Thanks, Mo.